When Breath Becomes Air is the title of this book, and the opportunity to reflect on it is in keeping with an overall view of the world that says that we can look to lots of different places and spaces for ways to connect ourselves to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, as you can tell from the book, this particular physician, Paul Kalanthi, if I believe that's how it's pronounced. I have no idea. I don't know. Kalanithi, is not a particularly religious person. He's not a Jewish person. But I suspect that when you read this book, you found that there were a lot of different important themes that can give us an opportunity to reflect and to really connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our own lives in our own way, even though I'm not a neurosurgeon. But I think there are many different themes. I'm curious if anybody thought there was one specific. The last time we did this, there were some competing themes. People thought about the man called Ov. Anybody thought there was a specific key theme that runs through this book?
I think everyone can take a different angle.
Right.
For me, it was really, and I think it's because of where I'm coming from with working in hospice, I think it was about advanced directives.
Okay.
And halachic ramifications, although it wasn't directly spoken about at the very end. But I think that there were a million themes in this.
Okay.
Interestingly, to compare, which is probably jumping, there's a different book called The Anatomy of Hope by Jerome Groopman,
okay,
who was a Jewish doctor and author, and he wrote specifically the power of hope and faith and how specifically faith plays its role in somebody's, you know, the trajectory of somebody's journey through an illness.
Okay, so he does talk about hope for those who are keeping scores. On page 133, he has a piece about the importance of hope and the role of hope, which is interesting. Yeah?
So for me, coming from where I'm coming from, I have a master's in communications, and to me, a lot of what I actually wrote down the sentence because it meant so much to me. I have come to see language as an almost supernatural force existing between two people, being our brains into communication. And then in breath, I mean, you know, the breadth of that in terms of his own development as a doctor, I thought was really astounding.
Yeah, so it's interesting because he's not just a doctor, he's also a writer. He's communicating. The whole book is a message that he's communicating to the world before he dies. I would say probably, at least to me, the theme of death was probably the most prominent theme in this book, and that's an interesting thing to think about from a Torah vantage point. You know, how much emphasis do we put in thinking about death? We have a very interesting statement. We have a traditional view that tov leleches lebeis evel, it's better to go to a house of mourning, mileleches lebeis mishta, than to go to a house of celebration. Because there is something that gives us pause that we can think about, you know, the bigger questions or what we're going to learn from that person. Very often you go to a shiva house and you just sit there and you listen to the stories that people tell or the reflections that people have, and you walk out, you're like, wow, there's a lot that can be accomplished by one person. So there is an element that, you know, the Chazal talk about in terms of Yaskir Lo Yom HaMisa. If we want to really recalibrate ourselves and figure out what we're trying to accomplish and how to keep ourselves in check, we need to remember that there is an end game. And that's probably one of the most overt themes in this book, that everybody dies. We all do. So if we are mindful of that, we're going to make the most of our time. I would actually want to start from the end. At the end of the book, he has kind of a coda. In my notes, I call this Sof Dovar. The message is simple. It's all the way at the end. When you come to one of the many moments in life where you must give an account of yourself, provide a ledger of what you have been and done and meant to the world, Do not, I pray, this is just, now this is the conclusion, discount that you filled a dying man's days with a sated joy, a joy unknown to me in all my prior years, a joy that does not hunger for more and more, but rest satisfied. In this time, right now, that is an enormous thing. So that piece obviously has to do with his wife. But the first point of the idea of giving an accounting for ourselves. That was his daughter? Oh, that was the daughter. The daughter.
Yeah, she was a baby.
Right. So what's he trying to say?
Well, I thought it was very interesting that he ended with that because I felt like so much of the book is sort of like grappling with like what do you do with the time you have left? And I thought like he made interesting choices along the way, like going back to work when he was so sick. And I thought, like, that's interesting. Like, obviously it gave him fulfillment and he felt that he had a mission and a purpose. And he also had this incredible drive to finish this book and was, like, half dead and writing it. So, like, that was an interesting turn to me at the end because I felt like, not that this hadn't appeared earlier, but I felt like it was ending on a note of family and of, like, sort of transmitting like the love that he had for his daughter, which didn't show up for me in the book as much as I thought.
That wasn't the big theme in the book overall. I thought that was interesting, but there's something also interesting about this, not just the fact that it's a message to someone, but what's the message? The message is you should know that even this small thing is meaningful. But that's the end. Part one is we need to make an accounting and recognize that there are these moments in life that we need to reflect. And when we do that, we realize that the little things matter.
But that was a little thing that his daughter had no control over.
Right, right.
She was just there.
Right. But that's the way he's framing it. So the end of the book of Koheles, in a certain sense, ends the same way. What's the last pasuk in Koheles? And Koheles is very much a similar type of book in that it's a struggle with meaning and the seeming despair over, you know, the blackness of futility. Sof dover hakol nishma, esu elokim yirav es mitzvosav shemor kizeh kol ha'adam. Do the right thing in the small moments. That's what it is. Because if you're trying to become this great historic figure and you're looking for immortality, it's never going to come. So he kind of ends the book by saying, you know, if you want to realize what really matters, it's important to know that just a few moments of joy matter to somebody.
Just you were saying how he's shown a lot about, you know, the importance of family, but yet you're talking about his choices. He made the choice, he knew he was dying. He made the choice to have a child before
right.
he died. So, like, he knew he was going to die when this child was still a baby, but yet it was still, he thought it was important enough to... You know,
right, and his family was always around. I wonder if maybe if I'm understanding you correctly. It was more there's not so much sentimentality about his family.
I guess that's a better way of saying it.
His brother is always with him. He spends a lot of time talking about his brother and his parents and his wife. But the sentimentality of that note is interesting in contrast.
And also, like the book when the wife takes over.
Yes,
you see that because she feels like you wrote a book that was cold. She even says that.
Yeah.
So I think that like that all is happening, but we don't get that sense of it until the end with the daughter and the parent, how close the family was, and you know the importance of family.
Her part like made me cry, and the rest of the book.
Yeah, he's very he's very calculating and cold. I mean, not bad, but that he had a certain message he wanted to get across, and he just didn't. He didn't deal with that aspect, I think.
Right. I think this message to his daughter is what he's learned about himself. Like, he spent 8 years on this neurosurgery residency, and he was almost at the end, and then this happens. And for him, his life was going to start when he was done. You know, he's going to become a professor and publish and travel and, you know, have a family. But he didn't get a chance to start his life other than this, what he called, grueling lifestyle, which it was. So I thought he was, like, telling his daughter, you don't have to be great like me, like I tried to be, in order to just live and be.
Interesting. I didn't see it that way, but I can hear that. Going back just to the previous point for 1 second, this question about sentimentality. One of the things that it seems that he's trying to convey that we think about a lot in Yiddishkeit, in two places in the book, he has one on page 76, for those who are keeping tabs, and another one on page 90. Here's a line that At one point, this is talking about Mrs. Harvey, the patient who dies on him, the first patient. At one point, she burst through a layer of paperwork to become my patient. And later on, he uses the expression that a person is not a problem to be solved. Meaning, yes, on the one hand, he's very much about the technical and the medical and the procedural, but he starts to understand, even through the training, that there is a human element, there is a personal element in every life that he's treating, and that there's not just the physical side of the person, there's also the emotional side of the person. This comes out in halacha a lot of different ways, maybe one unexpected way that you might not connect to this, but it's true in Hilchas Tzedakah. The Gemara Maseches Ksubas tells us that there's a principle in Hilchas Tzedakah called De Machsoro. You know, generally speaking, there is a laundry list of priorities when a person has to give tzedakah to take care of the various needs that are out there. Well, in that list, and now is not the time to make that calculus, but in that list is something called De Machsoro, the person's loss. So what does the Gemara say? How do you approximate? What does it mean, de machsoro, the amount that they are lacking? So the Gemara says, well, if someone is accustomed to driving with a carriage and four horses, and now they've fallen on hard times and they can't afford a carriage and not even one horse, so the mitzvah of tzedakah includes providing that person with a carriage and four horses. That does not, of course, take priority over somebody who can't put food on the table. But what does that mean? Why do Chazal include de machsoro, that this person who used to live a particular style of living and now can't afford that, so we who are Baruch Hashem, Alavai, we should always be on the giving end, should provide for that person to a standard of living that we ourselves might not hold ourselves to. Yeah.
I think it's about dignity.
Right, and where does the dignity come from? That comes from the emotional, the tzelem elokim. So yes, there's one din in Hilchas Tzedakah that a person needs their physical needs cared for. But then there's a totally separate understanding that there is a person who feels, whether rightly or wrongly, they feel that their stature has been diminished. They feel a sense of loss. That they used to live a certain lifestyle and now they can't afford that lifestyle anymore. Now, even though that might be objectively beyond what somebody else would ever imagine, but because they've lost that, we need to feel for them. We need to treat them as a person. And as a person, that means more than just the dollars that are in their bank account. There's one criterion, the Gemara says, has a whole calculation of 200 zuz for a person who is entitled to collect tzedakah based on their income. So that's one standard. De machsoro has nothing to do with your income. It has to do with psychologically where you are up to. And so that is the recognition that a person is more than just a physical makeup. And that's a parallel in Hilchas Tzedakah. So bringing it back to the treatment of the patient, of course we need to treat people not just as files or stacks of paperwork, but as human beings. And that also comes across when we think about the person on the other side of the story. So you mentioned his wife, right? The story is not about his wife, although she gets the last word with the conclusion of the book, but that's a whole nother aspect of a person who's ill and then a person who dies. What about the people who are left behind? So there are multiple layers of loss there. And the halacha, in a very profound way, relates to that, not just on the loss of the physical, but of course on the loss on the emotional side. So the institution of Shiva is for that purpose. It's for a person to be able to come to terms emotionally with their loss. I always remember my father had a coworker who years ago, I don't remember who in their family died, but somebody, he had a coworker or an employee, one of the lawyers who worked for him, who had a family member who died, and they had the funeral, whatever day it was, and then the person came back to work the next day. And then it was either the following day or that afternoon that he told my dad afterwards that he couldn't drive. He was in the middle of driving and he just was so upset and so sad that he pulled over on the side of the road and just broke down sobbing. And I remember when I heard this story, I was thinking to myself, yeah, because the person had no time to process that kind of devastating, monstrous loss. So the idea that the person needs to take care of themselves, yes, okay, you need to take care of the paperwork, and you need to fill out all the forms and the death certificate and all that stuff, but what about the person as a human being? That taking care of ourselves on an emotional level is really what the halacha is providing in Hilchas Avelos. And Rav Soloveitchik develops this idea about Avelos not just being the stuff that you do, but the kind of person that you are as you experience it. It's what he calls a kiyum shebelev. It's not just about sitting on the floor. It's feeling and getting into the emotional space to deal with that loss. And that's why sometimes you go to a shiva house, you have to, this is just a din, and it's also it's a smart eitzah, it's a wise intellectual ha'ara, it's an emotional observation. The din in Shulchan Aruch is that when a person goes to visit somebody in a shiva house, so you're not supposed to speak first. So why not? Why shouldn't you speak first when you go to visit somebody in a shiva house?
The person may not feel like speaking.
Yeah, they don't. You know, Dr. Pelkovitz talks a lot about how different people and different times we go through different stages. So sometimes we want to be attenders. We want to focus on something. And sometimes we want to be distractors. We don't want to talk about it. So it's about respecting the person who's going through this process to understand that they're a person. It's a shiva house is not just a pile of papers. It's not, you know, you come in, you check the box, you sit there. Bechlal, making a whole morning out of a shiva visit, bechlal, not a good eitzah. You know, sitting for like 4.5 hours, unless you're the person's very close friend. You need to take the cues that probably usually after about 10 or 20 minutes, they've probably had enough of you sitting there, but that's a separate point. But the idea of taking the cues from the oval, because it's really about their ability to process this emotionally, that's kind of what the closing of the book is, when his wife gets to write and start to process on her own. That's like her cathartic experience. Yes, someone had a hand before. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I think he was approaching it as the watcher, what was going on with him. Mm-hmm. And also as a scientist looking through things, but I also was so moved by, he had such a family support. It was so clear in the very beginning. His parents, with everybody, it was just his foundation. He's not going to quell love over it necessarily, telling, well, I think he did. And that gave him the strength to be this very strong and very hardworking person.
Right, the supportive community.
Yeah. And then go to the next level, and I say, like a watcher, he's now talking about what's going on, and he's reporting to us.
Right.
And
that's something that he mentions a few times in the book, the idea of the same person playing different roles, right? Sometimes he's wearing the lab coat, he's the doctor, and then he's the patient, he's the narrator, but he's also the subject of the book. The idea that he's playing different roles, he's wearing different hats, that comes up a few times, yeah.
I have a question. So from the beginning of his life, he was curious about the meaning of life, and he was, you know, from a writer to become a scientist, he was always pondering those questions of life and death. And in his work, he came so close to experiencing other people's deaths, and he was so fascinated by it. Don't you get the feeling that, in a way, he was kind of asking for it?
That he was so I don't know what to make of that. That's a good question. I'm really not sure. He has a line on page 81 that he is interested in what he says. He wants to pursue death, grasp it, uncloak it, and see it eye to eye.
Yeah.
That was a line.
Exactly.
That's just him accepting.
So that was his, part of his goal is why he wanted to be a neurosurgeon.
Right, this was before.
So there is, part of this is because it's a human mystery. If you look, the Gemara in the end of Maseches Moikatan, and Daf Chav Ches, has a whole discussion about death, different aspects of death. And there is, the Gemara recognizes that there is a fear about death. There is an uncertainty. So I don't think it's unusual for somebody to be curious about it. The Gemara even describes that one of the Amoraim had a colleague whom he knew was going to die. He said, could you tell me in a dream what the experience of death is like? And he describes it to him. So the idea that we're curious about this unknown and this transition is actually very much in our tradition. It's an interesting thing to think about. There is an article, which I can send you. This is called Death in the Writings of Rabbi Joseph Dov Soloveitchik. Sounds like it could be like a play, like a Broadway, off-Broadway, Death in the Writings of Rabbi Soloveitchik. All right. From Gerald Bloodstein, who's a very, very prominent scholar in Israel. This was written in 2011. So he talks about the whole question of how interested are we and are we not in death? How much should we be? And he talks about it through the prism of Rav Soloveitchik, who wrote about all areas of Jewish life, and he dealt with Avelos, and he dealt with the topic of death, and he has a couple of just interesting observations, because on the one hand, the halachic man, we as religious people, we're not so interested in death. Once a person dies, we can't fulfill any more mitzvahs. We can't accomplish the mission why our neshama was put here on this earth. So we're more focused on the here and now. We're busy figuring out, what am I going to do tomorrow morning? You know, what's going to be my life today? But on the other hand, there is a recognition that the role of death plays an important life in our awareness of what we're doing and how we're accomplishing it. So he makes two observations based on the teachings of Rav Soloveitchik, which are kind of opposite, that I thought were very interesting. He says on the one hand, and he talks about how Rav Soloveitchik talks about this, I don't think he quotes this essay, but in that point, he quotes an essay from the Rav about catharsis, where he talks about a person who experiences death and how monstrous and cruel and ugly it is. And some of that is reflecting on his own life. I think it was in 1 year that he lost his mother, his wife, and his brother. His wife died, I think, right before Purim. So he had that devastating experience. But in a different place, he says, well, that's only on an individual level, but on a global level, the idea of limits, that a person has a limit to their lifetime, is actually, on the whole, on the sum, a good thing. It gives us an opportunity to make way for others, for new ideas. Dor holech v'dor ba. And so there's this, not like a circle of life in a biological sense, but in a macro sense, that there are generations that need to make way for new generations. There are new trends and there are new ideas. So it's kind of an interesting way of thinking about that there's death on an individual level, which the halacha says that we have to stop. There's a chiyuv. The Gemara actually has a machlokas, Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Akiva, whether or not attending to the burial of a close relative, that's a reshus, or that's a chiyuv, that's an obligation. And then the requirement to observe Shiva and to process that, and that's very devastating. On the other hand, that's part of life, and that gives you a certain limit to accomplish something. And you know, I just thought that was a very interesting way of looking at it, that yes, on an individual level, but on the macro level, it's slightly different. So he has a whole essay discussing this topic, the idea of death in the writings of Rav Soloveitchik. There's one line here that I was curious what people thought about, where he talks to about the medical profession. Let's shift away from death for a second. Where he talks to one of the medical professionals that he's dealing with, and he says, all you need to do is say, I'm sorry. What happened is my fault. And that this particular physician could not bring themselves to say, I'm sorry, it was my fault. So what does that say about the medical professional? It probably doesn't say anything about medicine, because people in all areas of life are like that. But there's an interesting Gemara in the end of Maseches Kiddushin, where the Gemara has a phrase based on the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Tov Sheberofim LeGehenim. Any physicians? Children of physicians, related to physicians? Tov Sheberofim LeGehenim. So there are many, many interpretations of that line. One is that if the Rofe, the only thing he says to you is Tov, Tov, everything is fine, then that's bad news. But one interpretation is that a person who accomplishes so much in the world of medicine, a person can get the false notion that they've got it all under control. That there's a measure of arrogance, of hubris, that goes along with feeling that you are the healer. And one of the interesting things that at least came across to me in this book is the idea of humility. That he's struggling with, on the one hand, he knows he's brilliant and he tells you that he's brilliant, but on the same page, he could tell you that he doesn't know and that he is subject to, you know, consulting another doctor, or, you know, he's going back and forth between that, like, I know this, I should know this, but then saying, maybe I don't know this. I should ask for somebody else. I should ask for help. And the recognition with this other doctor that arrogance is going to be your end. And that's what he describes, that this person did not succeed. That the tov shebarofen legehenim, if a person feels like, I'm the best out there, I don't need to consult with anybody else, I don't need to second guess, I don't need to look back, so then that person is legehenim. Yeah.
He also kept grappling with that throughout, where he knew that he was making these decisions that would completely affect this person's outcome. And like he knew it was like he was playing God, but he knew he was not God. And it was like, that was a recurring theme, that it's just sort of like, that's what the doctors are, especially when you're dealing with like neurosurgery. And
isn't that what the Rebbe Shalom wants of us all the time? That he doesn't put us here, at least the majority opinion of the Jewish tradition is that we're not predetermined. He wants to put us here to accomplish something, to make choices, to build. Milu etzaretz v'chivshua, to develop the world. We have to come up with curing all of the diseases and fixing societal ills and building humanity. That's what the Rebbe Shalom wants us to do. But at the same time, not to say kol chivo tzim meldi asa le'esachai lazeh. Right? To step up to the plate, not to say, I'm going to sit back and God is going to cure cancer. God wants us to do research and cure cancer. But not to think that the ability to cure cancer is somehow self-made. And I think that actually is very much related to the definition of humility. When I first came to YU, for my first year and a half before I went to Rav Shechter Shir, my Rebbe was Rav Meir Twersky. So Rabbi Twersky once said something that was so striking, I still remember it to this day. He once said that the definition of humility is an accurate understanding of who you are and where you come from. That's humility. There's a story that Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky, who was a prominent dayan in England, was once called to testify in the British court. If you've ever been to a British court, they're very formal. They have the robes and the wigs and everything. So dayan Abramsky was asked by the prosecutor, are you the most important senior rabbi in all of the United Kingdom? And he said, yes, I am. So apparently, legend has it that the judge leaned over and he said, excuse me, rabbi, don't they teach you about humility? And he said, Your Honor, I'm under oath. Humility does not mean to lie about yourself. It's to know where you come from, where your kohos come from. That's why people who come from simple roots and are humble, they could be incredibly accomplished, but they don't shun or are embarrassed by the roots that they came from, because they recognize that's who they are. A person, Moshe Rabbeinu, knew that he was the greatest, most accomplished prophet that ever was and ever would be. But he knew that all came from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So he was Anav Mikol Adam. He didn't say it's all me. He said it came from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He gave me this opportunity. So it's that same thing. And Anav doesn't mean when they stand up and they say, can somebody volunteer? And Anav says, you know, who am I? I can't, you know. You know, they're looking for a volunteer, for somebody to lend a particular talent. You know, sometimes people are looking for someone to volunteer, for someone who's artistic to design something. And you have someone who's sitting there who's incredibly artistic, really gifted. And they say, who am I to volunteer? I'm a nobody. I'm a nothing. That's not humility. That's foolishness. But to say, I am a self-made artistic genius, that's arrogance. Right? Rather to say, God has given me a particular set of talents, and I'm going to use them in the service of God to help your project, whatever you need, you know, you whatever your thing is. So it's very much that same dynamic that the Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to do. He doesn't want us to sit back. He didn't say to the Jewish people, don't conquer the land of Israel because I'll do it for you. He said, you should fight, but remember that I'm giving you that ability. It's an interesting dynamic. Was that a hand before?
No.
In an art gallery, that would have been very, very costly. It was almost a hand. Yeah.
I think he's lacking humility more than anything else.
Why do you think that?
Because in no way did it seem like he was reflecting how his accomplishments were going to help the next generation. He wasn't saying, because of this great family, because of my supportive parents, brother, wife, anybody else, he was really saying, I'm struggling defining myself because I wanted to be a writer, and then I became this incredible, brilliant doctor, and now I'm going back to writing because I'm trying to find a sense of who I am when I'm facing this. But I don't think, as far as the next generation that you were talking about, when that intern came in to the room and he started saying, well, I'm just going to kind of wait until the next shift. I mean, you saw his frustration. Like, I can't leave and let this guy kind of take over what I've been working towards. So I think it was more, I think this was an ego that it kind of came cut short. Like, Being Mortal was, I don't know if you read that one, that was phenomenal. And that's,
Atul Gawande?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. And he really, his experiences watching, he was a doctor, watching his father die of a brain tumor, and how he took that situation and totally realized that he needed to change how he spoke to patients and have a conversation about death and what their wishes are. That, to me, is like taking a situation that's really difficult, and this goes back to the book you were talking about, The Power of Moments, taking a situation that might be, you know, horribly traumatic, but turning it into something positive. I think Being Mortal did this. I think that he didn't turn anything positive. He really wanted to talk about how brilliant he was, and then use his writing and those skills to kind of have this book to talk about his situation. But I don't think that he was humble in any way, and I don't know that he changed because of his diagnosis and knowing he was going to die.
So maybe we could split that comment into two parts. One is the question of change and how we react to a situation, and the first part is the humility. I'm not sure that a person going on a journey to figure out what they're supposed to be doing is a lack of humility. I'm not sure that his struggle with trying to figure out what he's going to do with the remainder of his life and how to make it meaningful is a lack of humility as much as it's a struggle to create meaning in whatever life he has, right? There's definitely an element. People who are very humble and self-effacing would not write this book. Right, this book is.
You would be a neurosurgeon if you were, you know.
Right.
If you were humble.
He was kind of true to himself up until the end, which is like a little bit of what I was trying to say before, which was like he's obviously someone who's like obsessed with self-actualization and has been his whole life. And so I thought it was interesting that when he's told you're going to die like imminently, instead of retreating and, you know, spending all of his time with family or sort of like having like this epiphany moment of like figuring out what life is really about, he just kind of doubles down and just tries to accomplish even more in the shorter time.
Is that a lack of humility, you think?
I found it a little bit off-putting, I'm not going to lie, just because I can't relate to that on a personal level, but I don't know that it's a lack of humility. It's just like being extremely driven and...
I think his doctor, Emma, the oncologist,
gave him that.
Almost like egged him on to do that. You know, every time he wanted to just forget it, I'm done, you know, she said, you have time.
Yeah.
And she actually predicted wrong.
Right. That was a little weird.
She actually predicted that
no,
in
but
5 years
that
and
was
didn't.
Whole, it was like a whole point that they kept saying also is like, no one knows when they're going to die.
Right.
And then it was like, even when you're told you have a terminal illness, you're going to die,
yeah.
you still don't know when you're going to die.
Right.
So he kept saying, if he had 3 months, then he would just spend time with his family.
Right.
But maybe he had 3 years. Maybe he had 10 years.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So if he had 10 years, like, he wasn't just going to do nothing for 10 years. So,
but he also has a better sense than most people of, like, what's actually happening.
But nobody really
him.
Knew.
No, for sure. But, like, as a neurosurgeon, like, he understood what he was up against. So, like, as much as she was telling him, like, oh, you're fine, like, he was, like, in the...
He looked at the scans.
Exactly.
Well, he wants it to believe one humble comment I remember he made is, when he first got diagnosed, everybody says, why me? But he said, why not me?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a sign of humility. That, you know,
so,
he's no different, even though he's a hot shot.
So I actually thought that that it's not a contradiction. I thought that he is, and he does several times... raise and come back to the question of why am I here? What am I doing? And his answer was exactly that,
yeah.
was I am here to accomplish this goal. So I'm going to put in every possible minute to accomplishing that goal.
Yeah.
But for us
to graduate,
no, the goal would be to serve his patients as a neurosurgeon. That was his most immediate goal. But I think the question is the key question. So each one of us is going to fill in the blank according to what we see. And the question is more important than the answer. The Yasker Lo Yom HaMisa, at least to me, the biggest takeaway of this book, of the Tovu Leches L'Beis Eva, why read this book, is because it makes us ask that question. What are we doing here? Why are we here? And so when we do that, we introspect, we understand what our kochos are, what our Kodesh Baruch Hu wants from us to a certain extent based on our skills, then we got to figure out, so what's the answer? Right? So for him, that was the answer. And it could be that maybe was the right answer for him. You know, who's to know? You know, everybody.
His doctor said that, you know, some patients like just plunge into their work, and some patients simply just spend time with their family. And the reason why people plunge into work so completely is to forget about it, to distract themselves.
Not necessarily to distract themselves. In his case, the reason he's plugging himself into his work so much is because he believes that's his calling.
Mm.
So every person in their own world, you know, if somebody is... their netia, their kochos are to do chesed. So then what are they going to do? They're going to double down on trying to get in as much chesed as they can. And everybody needs to figure out what their thing is. I'm not sure that that's a lack of humility as much as it's we're not used to or we don't associate, you know, this kind of personality with humility. But I'm not sure that it's arrogance that's pushing him to accomplish.
I did not get the sense that he was arrogant.
I think he's just
anything,
confident and.
Right. But I just kept saying when I was, I'm like, if I were sick, I would want him to be my doctor because he was so not your typical neurosurgeon, and he was so concerned about the patient and like looking at the big picture and like, you know, what is when, you know, what is quality of life and when do you push something and when do you let it go, and it was, yeah, like to me that I thought he was like the ultimate doctor.
He's like a philosopher.
Right. And most neurosurgeons are not like that.
Yeah.
Like, they're really just the scientist, and they're that, you know, person of, you know, oh, I'm godlike, and, you know, I have control, and I'll just do, you know, I'm the best. I don't think he ever felt like that. I don't think he ever thought that he was the greatest doctor out there. Like, he really grappled with all of his decisions.
I think an important takeaway, back to the language thing that for me was a thread throughout the book, is that all of us in our daily lives can impact, to me that could be called a sort of form of chesed in a way, because based on what we say and how we say it, we could change a person's life in a small way every day.
For sure. And I think that's probably part of that last comment about how even the few moments of his life were rewarded by having his daughter.
Exactly.
There was an interesting line when he talks about religion and God and Christianity. I don't know anything about Christianity, but he has something in there which I thought was very interesting that struck me as very un-Jewish or non-Jewish, where he talks about how in a Christian concept, page 171, that there is this idea, the Old Testament, he says, the Old Testament says you can never be good enough. Goodness is the thing, and you can never live up to it. The main message of Jesus, I believed, is that mercy trumps justice every time. Not only that, and then he goes on. And I was wondering if that's something that we need to make sure that we're not espousing in our Yiddishkeit. Because if we're telling people that, we're selling them something that's not Jewish, and we're setting them up for a very unfulfilled life. Adaraba, in a Jewish tradition, the idea that we can't be good enough is the clear emphasis. That it's not that we can't be good enough, it's that we can. So I thought that he has an interesting discussion there about godliness in general and religion, but the notion, I don't know anything about Christianity, could be he's totally misrepresenting it. But if that was me, I would be off the derech from Christianity, which I am. That's not what I'm signing up for. You know, in Yiddishkeit, my rabbeim told me that we can be good enough. So I just want to make sure that nobody walks away with the wrong thing. I want to conclude with a story. This is an incredibly powerful story because I do think that as a religious person reading this book, it comes back to the same question that he's alluding to and that the book is asking us, which is, how do we lead our lives? Right? Is it that we just go all in and say that my work is going to be my legacy? Is it that there is something else that I'm supposed to accomplish? But that comes back to the awareness that at the end of the day, there's going to be an end. There's going to be what we call a din v'cheshbon. There's another world. There's the immortality of the soul. That we understand that death, there's actually, in the halakhic tradition, there's a limit to how much mourning should happen. Person shouldn't be misabel yolser me die. Why not? Because that would give the impression, if a person mourned excessively, that the person who died is gone. The person's not gone. They just transitioned to the other world. But we still have that connection. We still have a spiritual connection to them. And so when we think about the idea of death and Yazkir lo Yom HaMisa, it reminds us that there is a spiritual world and that we are a neshama and that we're going to have something to show for ourselves at the end. And that's, I think that is the recurring theme underneath this book, that there is a day that everybody's name is going to be called, so we have to have something to show for it. So do we live not with a crippling and morbid sense of Yazkir lo Yom HaMisa? Maybe some people like that. I'm not a big fan of that. Like the idea that, you know, but the idea that there is an end game and what does that look like, where lifnei mi'ata asad litin din v'cheshbon, brings us back to the fact that we are a neshama and that we're supposed to lead a godly life. Yes?
So how would this story be different if he were, or would it be different if he were an Orthodox Jew?
So I suspect that it probably depends on a person's temperament and what they were doing. You know, if their work were writing a sefer, so they might focus on that. If their primary focus was
a neurosurgeon.
Right. So I think it probably depends on your personality, because the Rebbe Shlomo made different people differently. So I suspect that depending on your circumstance, but I think here would be the one common denominator. And that is that the Rabbona Shalom would be part of the conversation. Yeah. So here's the story. I heard the story, and I wasn't sure if it was true or not. So I emailed Dov Carroll, who is special old Skokie landsman, who was Rav Lichtenstein, Zichrono Levracha, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zatzal, his right-hand man at the end of his life. So as I was preparing, I sent him an email. I said, did you ever hear this story? Is this story really true? So he says, I'm not sure that this story happened with Rav Aaron. I heard it happened with the Rav Soloveitchik, his father-in-law, but let me check it out. 5 minutes later, he sends me back another email. I heard about this story. 10 minutes later, he sends me back another email. Here's the story. The story was reported by Esti Rosenberg, Rav Lichtenstein's daughter. And in her hesped, when Rav Aaron, who was an incredible person, just an exceptional human being, and one of the most refined Jews you could ever imagine, one of the most accomplished Ovdei Hashem of our generation, whom I had the privilege to meet or to be in the same spatial proximity of, you could call it. He says, she says, Tova was giving, she was one of the maspidim at the Levaya for Rav Lichtenstein, his daughter. She describes, she says in the Hesped, a year and a half, Kishana v'chetzi lefnei p'tirascha, a year and a half before you passed away, she's speaking to the Aaron. On Yom Revi Sha'achrei Parsha Shmos, it was Wednesday after Parsha Shmos, by that time his health was starting to fail. Nasanu b'yachad b'ambulance, and this is from the written transcript of what she said at the Levaya. We traveled together in the ambulance. You lie there on our way to the hospital. And we didn't know how long this hospital stay was going to be. And you were kind of mumbling and talking in words of Torah and davening. Al pasuk echad, on one pasuk, chazarta shuv v'shuv. You started to come back to the same pasuk again and again. Hischalta b'sheket, you started quietly. V'kol chaholach v'hiskaber umile eschalal ha'ambulance. You started to get louder and louder. And I remember of Lichtenstein, he could be very loud. He could be very soft-spoken, but he could also be very loud. B'yadcha afkiruchi podi sa'osi Hashem kel emes. In your hand, I give my spirit. You have redeemed me, Hashem. You are the God of truth. In the beginning, she says, you were saying this davening quietly. And then after that, you screamed louder and louder, B'yarcha afkid ruchi, B'yarcha afkid ruchi. Your voice filled the ambulance with your tefillah, with that phrase. And she says, again and again, over the last year and a half, In my mind, I went over that pasuk that you kept saying. I knew that this was the feeling that you had in your entire life, and specifically in the last 2 years when you were not in the best of health. That is, to me, such an incredible description of what it means to face death. Obviously, he knew that he wasn't well. He didn't know how long he would have. It turns out he would live for another year and a half after this ambulance ride. But the notion that a person lives their life with the awareness that b'yadcha afked ruchi podisa osi Hashem kel emes, that to me is the ultimate accomplishment. So if you were to ask, how would a person who was a religious person, a spiritual person, an Eved Hashem tzigizin, lead their lives and write this book? That's, Rav Lichtenstein says, that's what he taught us would be the way to write this book.
Can you translate that again, please?
B'yadcha, in your hand, afkid, the word afkid means to make a pikadon, which literally means to, how do you say pikadon in English? To make someone a custodian, to pass over, to give over. B'yadcha afkid ruchi, in your hand, I give over my spirit. Padisa osi Hashem, you have redeemed me, kel emes, you are the truthful God. That was the mantra of his the recesses of his soul, when he wasn't even lucid, she says, but that's what animated his whole life. And so, if we think about our lives, what does it mean to be aware of the fact that everybody is going to die at some point? It's to recognize that our life is a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Our neshama is a pikadon. And the Rebbe Shem gave it to us, and we have to use it to the best of our accomplishments, to the best of our abilities, we want to try to make sure that that neshama goes back as shiny and as pristine and as elevated, even more elevated, as it was when we got here in the first place. So this idea of facing the end with that awareness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our lives can inform how we lead the rest of our lives. And each one of us, we have to figure out what our mission is going to be. Yeah. Closing comments?
That what I see every day facing, people facing exactly what he was doing. And I have the wonderful opportunity of talking to these people. And I work in a Jewish department, so everyone I talk to is Jewish in some shape or another. And I find that the people who have real faith have what I call a peaceful, softer landing when it comes to their death. Because there's an understanding that there's a higher being, and there's a meaning that may or may not make sense. And it's just, it's because it's also a daily reminder for me, you know, for that also, is that until my day comes, I need to live my life like that every single day, because it could be taken away in a heartbeat. But I always say when I meet somebody at work is, I have so much to learn from you, and I hope there's something that I can give you in the process. Because that vulnerability and that faith at that time in their life is incredible and bigger than anything that you can really articulate. And I find it absolutely fascinating that there's a difference. When someone will say to me, you know, as a child, I used to go to temple or whatever it is, do you think you could say that prayer? And it always goes back to Shema. And I'll say Shema with them at the end, and there's this peace. And to me, that's totally what it's about. And I think, again, not to rip a little bit on the book, but I think like the last lecture was a different story.
Right.
That was giving of himself to other people and a reflection of what was important in his life. And this was
not... Right, this is like not an ethical will. This is not like that at all. No,
but knowing, like, this is what I'm worth, and how much more can I push it at the very end? Because I was meant to accomplish a lot. And that's kind of how I saw his arrogance, why I didn't see the humility. But I think that I kept looking for some kind of faith. And I'm like, I wonder, you know, how... When I first read it the first time... How is this going to end for him? Because he seems to be struggling with his own issue and not really that his time is up.
Right. I hear that.
Do you think his daughter is going to go into medicine or stay far away?
I don't know. It's a good question.
No, but he said he didn't want... He said he was not going to go into medicine because his father was...
Right.